بره اجر كشري اشو تورو شو تشو يشي ما رزمان غريس سيسي باكت برانتو سامي برو بار كي جاي راجع غرانتو شي ما باغو تام كي جاي قول بمنن دي all glories to the assumma devotees all glories to shri shri guru and gauranga O namo bhagavate vasudevaya. This is not the correct Bhagavatam. This is part two, and part one. O namo bhagavate vasudevaya. O namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om Agyanta Mirandasya Pinanjana Shalakaya Shakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shinguruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Adati Swapadantikam Vanchakalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Merevacha Patita Nam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadaha Shivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 2, Text number 4 and 5. Text number 4, translation. The apsara sent by Lord Brahma began strolling in a beautiful park near the place where the king was meditating and worshipping. The park was beautiful because of its dense green foliage and golden creepers. There were pairs of varied birds such as peacocks, and in a lake there were ducks and swans, all vibrating very sweet sounds. Thus the park was magnificently beautiful because of the foliage, the clear water, the lotus flowers, and the sweet singing of various kinds of birds. Text 5, translation. As Purvachiti passed by on the road in a very beautiful style and mood of her own, the pleasing ornaments on her ankles tinkled with her every step. Although Prince Agnija was controlling his senses, practicing yoga with half-open eyes, he could see her with his lotus-like eyes. And when he heard the sweet tinkling of her bangles, he opened his eyes slightly more and could see that she was just nearby. Purpur, it is said that yogis always think of the Supreme Personality of Godhead within their hearts. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is always observed by yogis who practice controlling the venomous senses. As recommended in Bhagavad Gita, yogis should practice sampriksha nasighagram, keeping their eyes half open. If the eyes are closed completely, there will be a tendency to sleep. So-called yogis sometimes practice a fashionable form of yoga by closing their eyes and meditating, but we have actually seen such so-called yogis sleeping and snoring while meditating. This is not the practice of yoga. To actually practice yoga, one should keep his eyes half open and gaze at the tip of his nose. Although Agnidra, the son of Priyavrata, was practicing mystic yoga and trying to control his senses, the tinkling sound of Purvachiti's ankle bells disturbed his practice. Yoga Indriya Samyama. Actual yoga practice means controlling the senses. One must practice mystic yoga to control the senses, but the sense control of a devotee who fully engages in the service of the Lord with his purified senses, Hirishikena, Hirishikesha Sevanam, can never be disturbed. Srila Prabodhananda Saraswati therefore stated, Durdantindriya Kala Sarpapatali Protkattatamstra Yate. The practice of yoga is undoubtedly good because it controls the senses, which are like venomous serpents. When one engages in devotional service, however, completely employing all the activities of the senses in the service of the Lord, the venomous quality of the senses is completely nullified. It is explained that a serpent is to be feared because of its poisonous fangs. But if those fangs are broken, the serpent, although it seems fearsome, is not at all dangerous. Devotees, therefore, may see hundreds and thousands of beautiful women with fascinating bodily movements and gestures, but not be allured. I don't think that's recommended. Whereas such women would make ordinary yogis fall. Even the advanced yogi Vishwamitra broke his mystic practice to unite with Menaka and beget a child known as Shakuntala. The practice of mystic yoga, therefore, is not sufficiently strong to control the senses. Another example is Prince Agnidra, whose attention was drawn to the movements of Purvachiti, the Apsara, simply because he heard the tinkling of her ankle bells. In the same way that Vishwamitra Muni was attracted by the tinkling bangles of Menaka, Prince Agnidra, upon hearing the tinkling bangles of Purvachiti, immediately opened his eyes to see her beautiful movements as she walked. The prince was also very handsome. As described herein, his eyes were just like the buds of lotus flowers. As he opened his lotus-like eyes, he could immediately see that the Apsara was present by his side. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. In the first paragraph, Srila Prabhupada says that a yogi means one who is always thinking of the Supreme Personality of Godhead within himself. And generally, when the yogis do practice, they keep half-open eyes. And the idea is that if the eyes are completely closed, then one's tendency to sleep will be stronger. We have experience with that. And if the eyes are completely open, then all the sense objects will be attracting one. So then the mind will become restless. So half-open eyes and practice meditating on the Supreme Lord within their hearts. So for controlling the senses, which are the senses are compared to venomous serpents, we also sing daily, that the senses are a network of paths that leads to death. So they look harmless, but they can destroy a person's life when left uncontrolled. They destroy a person's existence. So they're compared to venomous serpents. Just like a venomous serpent bites you, then the poison can kill you. So similarly, when the senses are controlled and they are not controlled and they're allowed to associate with their sense objects unrestrictedly, then such a relationship causes the utter destruction of the individual in the form of an excessive lust, anger, greed, etc., which are the gateways that lead to hell. So it's most important to control the senses. There are examples given to describe, to help give understanding of how the senses are a network of paths leading to death. Different species of life are given as examples to help us get the picture. It's like a moth is attracted by seeing the form of fire, and so he enters into the form of fire. So also our eyes, we get attracted by seeing many things. And then generally the ruination of our intelligence begins with form. Generally it begins with form more than other things. Our intelligence, it is first seeing the sense object that causes the destruction of the intelligence. Just like I remember hearing in Delhi, there was a... In Delhi, they noticed that there was an increase in car accidents, and they were trying to understand why this was the case. I heard this from some devotees in India. I don't know if this is true or not, but at least the point is nice. There was an increase of car accidents in Delhi, and they were trying to figure out why. And then they realized that they had put, billboards up, of basically, naked women, essentially, in essence. And so, in India, when driving, you have to be extremely attentive. One moment of inattention is death. It's not like when chanting japa. We can be inattentive the whole time. It doesn't make any difference. But when driving in India, a moment of inattention, that's your life. So they were noticing an increase in car accidents, and they, oh, so many billboards. So people see the form, oh, you know, and then finished. For example, this is the beginning of the ruining of the intelligence, seeing the form. Therefore, in Vedic culture, everyone was taught to dress. There's dress code for Vedic culture to, in order to protect one another from being victims of our senses. You know, dress code is there. Sometimes, you know, in the modern culture, they don't want to honor such things. You know, particularly, it is highly encouraged a kind of promiscuity in the dress code. And then improper things are done, you know, at least, I remember one devotee, he was living here, Bhakti Jerry, his brother was doing some work for us. And I told this before, he came to the temple and he had mentioned one of his worldly pastimes, and where he was happened to be in the gap. And one, you know, mother was there, she's not properly dressed. So he was just looking at her. That was not very cultured, obviously. But he didn't care. He didn't consider himself a very cultured person. So he just was looking. And, you know, and she said, "What are you looking at?" And he said, "I'm looking at you." He told quite straightforwardly. Because she was dressed in a promiscuous way, and so he was attracted. You know, intelligence was, you know, becoming victim of lusty senses and so on. So therefore, the dress code was there to help protect. You know, for example, you know, like in Islam countries, and women, they have a whole gear. Some people think that is quite oppressive and so on. But at least the principle makes sense. You know, in Vedic culture also, they used to wear veils also. Probably a little bit more attractive. It wasn't like all black. It's very colorful. If you go into India in the villages, you can see the mothers, they still wear veils. But it's very colorful. It's not like in Islam exactly. But then the principle is there. You know, chastity, you know, because the eyes, it's a problem. The eyes is a problem. It's the beginning of the ruining of the intelligence. So traditionally, in Vedic culture, women would even cover their head. They would wear braid, cover their heads, keep everything nicely covered. This is important. This is part of the culture. And it can be said, well, you should control your senses, Prabhu, like that. No, you know, well, I'm a conditioned soul, Mataji, you know, and then this is going on. This is, and you can't expect that the conditioned souls are going to be totally, you know, subdued, you know, in front of the sense object. So there's a culture, this culture, primarily because of the uncontrolled senses, which is a problem for conditioned souls. So the moth to the flame, he's attracted by the form. This is the beginning of the ruining of the intelligence. Then so many other examples are given. The fish gets caught by his tongue. So, you know, the fisherman puts a bait on the hook and then the fish goes after it and he's killed. So similarly, due to the attraction, the pressure put on the living entity from the tongue, the wanting to taste this and taste that and taste this and taste that, just because of this particular pressure, you know, the whole world economic situation, environmental situation is being completely destroyed just to satisfy the taste of the tongue. The tongue is considered the most important sense to control because the Bhagavatam's example is that by fasting, one can exhaust all the power of the other senses. But the tongue becomes more voracious by fasting. The other senses become weakened due to fasting, but the tongue becomes more powerful. Therefore, if one controls all his other senses, but his tongue is uncontrolled, then it cannot be said that he's sense controlled. And if his tongue is controlled, then it can be understood, oh, he's controlled all his senses. The Bhagavatam mentions this in the 11th canto. Like this, I'm not going to go through all the examples. All the examples are there. The deer gets attracted by the flute song of the hunter. So he goes chasing after that sound, and then he's brought into a particular place, and then the hunter shoots him and kills him. Like this, so different senses are given to show our senses victimize living. Even from one who's endeavoring to control them, Krishna says. For even from one who is, the senses are so strong and impetuous that even from one who's endeavoring to control them, that they are not able to do so. It is not such an easy thing. The senses are very powerful, especially in the age of Kali. Kala, Kali, Valena, Indriya, Vairi, Varga. Prabodhananda Saraswati Thakur, he also prays in this way, that it is the age of Kali and the senses have become very powerful enemies. Very powerful enemies. So anyway, underlying the urges of the senses, there's a misconception of life. So you'll read in the Nectar of Instruction, and Prabhupada's quoting Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's Anuvritti commentary, he tells that the material conception of life creates three types of urges. So underlying the urges of the senses is the material concept of life. So in the case here, we're hearing about Maharaj Anidra, although controller of the senses, if the conception of life is not addressed, then ultimately that control will be only superficial, and it's only a matter of time before the senses will manifest their venomous nature again. So the real problem is not so much the senses, but the concept of life that we're working with. That is the hardest thing to transform for the living entity. So, Prabhupada's quoting this verse, Sarva upadi vinir muktam tapuritena nirmalam hrishikena hrishikesha sevanam bhaktir uchite. That the devotee, he easily controls his senses. Why? It's mentioned here because his senses are engaged in relationship to Krishna. But before that, Sarva upadi vinir muktam, because his mind has been washed clean of all designations. Unless the mind is washed clean of the material designations, then he cannot release the senses from being similarly designated. Just like I have the material designation of myself as, one who likes whatever, meat. Somehow has such a conception. I really love meat. So because of that mental designation, so the senses also become similarly designated. And as a result, they become attracted to such things. I have a designation of myself as a man, so then my senses are similarly designated. They become attracted to the things that a man will be attracted to. I have a designation of myself as a woman, so my senses are similarly designated, and they become attracted to things which are like this, and it goes on. So unless the mind is washed cleansed of designations, then one can put up a show of sense control, but how long is it going to last? Prabhupada's mentioning that the devotees are so sense-controlled that even if hundreds and thousands of beautiful women with fascinating bodily movements and gestures were to be dancing in front of them, they would not be allured. So I don't think he's talking about any sadhaka here. Definitely not. He's talking about a devotee, one who's actually a devotee of the Supreme Lord. A devotee means one who realizes himself as the eternal servant of Krishna. So he cannot be allured by anything in this material world as a result of his spiritual conception of life. Srila Prabhupada also told the same thing to a reporter. The difference between you and I is I can be in a room full of naked women and not be disturbed, and you cannot. And the reporter's friend started laughing. Oh, this is very true, very true. And what is the reason? Because Prabhupada knows his position as eternal servant of Krishna. So Maharaj Agnidra, of course, he went to the park with the whole idea of catching one, mother, and so he can have a good child. And that was his whole concept. So super austere, send me a girl, send me a girl, send me a girl, chanting japa like that. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. Sometimes people do like that, actually. They want some wife or some husband. They'll be seeing them trying the most intense japa, and you're thinking, man, they really got some taste going on there. Yeah, it's a fact. Taste for the stool. Attract some stool-like corpse called a man or some stool-like corpse called a woman. And chanting 64 rounds like that, no problem. It can be seen because the lower taste is very strong. So Maharaj Agnidra went to the forest with that whole intention in mind. So then Krishna made an arrangement. Immediately his mystic trance was disturbed. He was meditating, and all of a sudden he heard the ankle bells of Purvachiti, and then he His eyes were half open, and then when he heard the angel bells of Purvachiti, immediately and then he saw, oh, she was just nearby.
That's what the verse says. She was just nearby.
Even very advanced yogis, they fall down. It is seen that they fall down on account of being victim of the mind and senses, and that is because ultimately no one can control the mind and senses. The mind and senses are a product of Krishna's Maya Shakti, and Krishna's Maya Shakti is only under his control. So for those who think that they can control it, ultimately they will be unsuccessful in the long run. And the only way to actually control the mind and senses is by surrendering to Krishna. Mam eva ye prapadyante mayami tam tarantite. Only by surrender to Krishna, giving one's body, mind, words completely over to the services of Krishna, can we be hopeful in controlling the mind and senses. Otherwise, there is no question of controlling them in this material world. And for one who fails to do so, then his life will be totally inauspicious. Totally inauspicious. The reason we have so many material desires is on account of uncontrolled mind and senses. Because the senses drag us to the sense objects, and then the mind begins contemplating them. And when the mind contemplates those sense objects, the sense objects enter into the mind as desires. So for one who fails to restrain the horses from their sense objects, then his mind will be filled up with desire, desire after desire after desire. Sometimes we go, why am I having so many desires? It's because we're weak in the application of mind and sense control. Therefore, our hearts are polluted by so many desires. Therefore, our only hope is to surrender to Krishna, surrender to his order, surrender to his system for elevation, like that, the principles of the regulative principles of devotional service. And that way, control the senses. And in the meantime, performing deep hearing and chanting to watch ourselves cleanse of the material conception. So we can have our program of sense, you know, regulative principles, to keep ourselves a little bit together from being victims of our senses. We have our way of interacting in the community of devotees, and to, you know, certain dress codes should be, then all these things that they give assistance. What is the assistance for? So that you can do focused shravanam and kirtanam to watch the body, the mind and the heart cleansed of the material designations. That is the actual point. So it's not like, in other words, we shouldn't take shelter of the regulative principles in and of themselves. Like, that's going to be a protection. And the ultimate, it is seen repeatedly, even here in Chicago, how, you know, accidents take place on account of, and everyone's following very nicely the regular principles, and suddenly, boom. So if one doesn't have deep, if they're not taking deep shelter of Shravanam and Kirtanam, we can hardly hope that we're going to be, you know, it'll just be a gritting the teeth program before fall down. So there has to be, the regular principles are in place, but that's to make us, our minds intent on bhajan, hearing and chanting about Krishna, so that can cleanse us, chetodarpanamarjana, that can cleanse us of the material designations. Then there's no question of falling down. Otherwise, there's no hope. So are there any questions? I gave short class. Yeah. How we grow in the attitude of surrender and how we practice it. Well, there are six aspects of surrender discussed. Sharanagati, six principles of Sharanagati. Accepting things which are favorable for the development of Krishna consciousness. Rejecting things which are unfavorable for the development of Krishna consciousness. Knowing that Krishna is my only protector. Knowing Krishna is my only maintainer. Completely, you know, Atmanivedana means completely giving up body, mind, words to the services of Krishna, and utter humility. These are the six limbs of surrender. You can see that in Bhagavad Gita 1866, chapter 18, verse 66, you know, Mame Kam Sharanam Vrajasa. Prabhupada talks about the six angas there. So this is the practice. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has wrote a songbook of, I think, composing of 32 songs dealing with Sharanagati, these six limbs of surrender, and delineating the attitude of the devotee
as he is practicing these various angas of surrender. So we can recommend you to go and read that or look at that for further insight. Surrender is, the attitude of surrender is easily practiced under the authority, under some spiritual authority, like the spiritual master. Because basically, surrender, the essence of surrender is doing what Krishna wants us to do. So like Krishna spoke the whole Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna said, Arjuna, did you understand what I spoke? You understand the message? We would have said, yes, Krishna. He said, what did you understand? I should do mystic yoga system. You know, we would have told something completely off, and he would, I just wasted my time, you know. Hey, Arjuna, did you understand what I spoke? You understand my, yes, I've understood. My illusion is now dispelled. Oh, what is the evidence? I'm ready to do as you want. That is, oh, very good. Karishe vachanam tava. I will do as you want me to do, Krishna. He's understood. Good, I didn't waste my time. So the attitude of surrender is easiestly practiced, let's say, under an authority, especially because things come down to us that we don't like to hear. And in that time, the surrendered attitude is really tested. Because I have my own program, I have my own way of doing things, and so on. And I've been mentioning this recently to devotees, that precipitating service is surrender. There's no question of bhakti without surrender. First surrender, then serve. And that can be easily understood by the fact that the qualification for service to Krishna, bhakti, the qualification for bhakti is shraddha. This is the main qualification, faith. The qualification for gyan is, you know, utter, the testing of the material atmosphere. The qualification for karma is I want to enjoy. The qualification for bhakti is faith. And this is Bhakti Nota course language. The external symptoms of shraddha in a real way is sharanagati. He says this is the external symptom of, so faith being like an internal feature, and surrender, the activities of surrender, as I've already delineated, is the external expression of faith. So bhakti needs faith, which is externally expressed as surrender. That is the adhikar. So even if one is very fallen, if he can surrender, he can be saved. So precipitating service, the land of service, sevadham, devotional service means entering into the realm of service. But the key to entering such a realm is surrender. So that surrendering process begins with accepting a bona fide spiritual master. So the attitude is best followed under such a spiritual master, spiritual authorities, primarily because instructions are coming and the living entity does not like to follow anyone. He wants to act whimsically. Ya shastra vidim ushtrigya vartate kama karataha. Krishna says, they reject the authority and they do as they like. Vartate kama karata, as I like, I shall do. That is the whole mentality of the conditioned soul. So then, many times, even when we're doing service, we're generally operating in a realm that's comfortable for us. So therefore, it's easy to think, I'm doing devotion, I'm in a service mood. And then as soon as some service comes that we don't like to do, immediately our attitude is exposed. What is this? We get frustrated, this and another. So this is a way to authenticate it, you know, that, okay, I need, you know, and then that time you get an opportunity, you know, to surrender or, you know, there are many nuances to this, but this is like I'm just speaking like a general principle, essence. These are the six angas that are there. That's the practice of surrender. The attitude is easily, more easily erected under some spiritual authority. That way we get to see also, like that, how much surrender we are. Okay, I think I saw. Wait, I don't know who I saw. Okay.
Hare Krishna. You mentioned that if our designation of ourself is a man or this or that, then the senses will be attracted accordingly. My question is that before we actually meet Krishna again, is it really possible to conceive of ourselves besides being theoretic about being a servant?
Yes, and it begins with service to Guru. That is the beginning. Without spiritual master that one's following, that means guru, you accept guru and guru accepts you. That is how the initial seed of that conception is born. Bhakti Lata Bija means the seed of devotion to Krishna, is given by the guru. One has to see himself as servant of guru first.
But isn't it still, at that point it's not theoretic, if you see yourself as a servant of a guru?
It could start off somewhat theoretical, but it will increase by service to the spiritual master's orders. It will deepen.
So then the tinges of some other conception will still be there until you actually...
They'll be there until one attains perfection.
What's the difference between artificial mind and sense control and authentic mind and sense control?
What is the difference between artificial sense control and authentic mind and sense control? Artificial means without a relationship to Guru and Krishna. And authentic means with a relationship to Guru and Krishna. There may even, so the yogis, Prabhupada's giving an example of the yogis, without a relationship. We can speak about it in like practical terms by using the word accountability. That gives it like a practical element to it. That whereas the yogis and other such persons, they have no relationship. Prabhupada uses the language in Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, I think text 66 or 67, that without, maybe someone can give me a Bhagavad Gita, I can more easily find it. Without a relationship to Krishna, then whatever show of peace anyone is making is just a show. It's not authentic, as you said. Authentic means in relationship to Guru and Krishna, there's inner accountability. So I'm engaging my senses according to their desire. It means in devotional service in a broad sense. Like that. The yogis don't have that relationship. So then ultimately, when the right situation comes up, or the wrong situation comes up, then without that relationship of accountability, then they fall down. Yes, Prabhupada says here, therefore, one who is engaged without a relationship with Krishna is certainly always in distress and is without peace, however much he may make a show of peace and spiritual advancement in life. It's a nice statement. I always like that statement. That's like a general point. Just like, so give it a practical example. I was told not to eat sweets on this day. Only on this day I can eat sweets, and on other days I can't eat sweets. But the sweets are always out. And they look very, oh, now they're over there. They look very attractive. They look, oh, the sweets are there. So then without a relationship, then what do you get? Naturally, the sense is like, go over there, buddy. Let's get 2, 3, 4 pieces like that. But with a relationship of accountability to Guru and Krishna, the senses are also going to give you the same suggestion. Mine will give the same suggestion in an immature state. Let's go over and take 4 pieces. But then you have the relationship that, well, I was told like this. And that relationship was more important to me than having 4 pieces of burpee. You know, so like that, when there's a relationship, it's like, okay, the senses are presented before me, and then you have a question to ask yourself, which one is more important? You know, this relationship with Guru and Krishna, or some temporary paltry sense gratification? You know, and if we are lucky enough to hit the pause button like we were hearing yesterday and ask ourselves that question, you know, because generally generally the senses are impassioned, so it just acts immediately. But if we were lucky enough to ask that question before acting, wait, the senses are walking over there. You're walking full speed ahead, you know. And then in midway, the question comes to their mind, which one is more important for you, the relationship And then you turn around, look at the deities, and they're smiling. You know, maybe a picture of your guru is on the altar or something, or the burfi. And depending on the type of affection, then you say, no, the relationship is more important. I'll not take the four burfis. And then, you know, it goes away. Then the mind will tell you something else and something else and something else. So wherever the mind runs, Krishna says, bring it back. So our determination means bringing the mind back to our relationship of accountability to Guru and Krishna. This will be authentic. Sometimes it will be seen that even such devotees may fall down, but they can easily recover because of the relationship with Guru and Krishna. Whereas others who are without that sense of shelter, then they will fall down, they will go away. That is also seen. So it is a most fortunate living entity who has shelter and a personality. That is the most fortunate living entity. Then it can be more authentic. Like that. Anyway, some food for thought. Anyone else wants to say anything? Yes?
Thanks, Ruth. Yesterday or a few days ago, you made a nice comment that I was reflecting on, that the difference between a neophyte and advanced devotee is that, like an advanced devotee, in other words, he doesn't flirt with Maya. The neophyte devotee thinks he can.
Yeah.
The advanced devotee, he knows something, limitations or something.
Yeah.
And so he respects the energy by not. Could you expand on that? I was just trying to get a better understanding.
Can you give me a second of part of the fifth canto? You remember the verse? I mean, what's to expand? It's clear.
We also hear that, like, an advanced devotee, like, in a pure devotional position, that he's no longer attracted anyway by it. So what would he be, you know, he's aware of what then? It's not necessarily. That sense of attraction is still there. He just doesn't act on it, or he's completely devoid.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to predicate the mind of the great souls, you know. But one of the qualities of those who are spiritually advanced is dānya. They're very humble. So you see, like Prahlad Maharaj's prayers, how many prayers he offers, and his prayers to Nrsimhadev, the whole first section of his prayers is just humble offering, dānya. I'm born in the family of demons. What is the question of me offering prayers to you? But you are very merciful, and the living entity can purify himself by offering prayers, so I'm offering prayers for my own purification. But in chapter 10, when Nrsimhadev gives him so many, take a boon, Prahlad Maharaj again reasserts, I'm born in a family of demons, and if you put all these attractive things in front of me, I'm going to be attracted. So, you know, don't give me any boon. My only boon is that I shall always remember you as a master, my position as a servant, and let that be our relationship. So one of the qualities of a devotee is humble, because the devotee will understand that he is Tathasta Shakti, or coming from the Tathasta Shakti. I mean, very tiny, jiva. And therefore, he can be allured by the material energy because of his constitutional position as so tiny. Anuchit Vastu, he's so tiny that I can't actually be attracted by the material energy. Therefore, I must make determined efforts to keep my mind focused on Krishna. That is aspect of his humility. There is no question of you being attracted. You're already situated and pure Krishna consciousness. And then the answer to that is, this is the reason why. Because I know my constitutional position. And therefore, I focus on Krishna and not on Maya, knowing that I can be attracted to Maya. Srila Prabhupada's famous story is there, giving some insight into that. Praying. The pure devotee can never fall down, and then during the morning walk, and then during Govinda's prayer, Prabhupada praying, may I not fall down. And the devotee seeing that and asking Srila Prabhupada, you just said that you can never fall down. Now why are you praying? And Prabhupada said, now you know why I will never fall down. And you guys don't pray. You think I am impervious to fall down. Therefore, taking big risk in the kitchen in the pujari room and falling down or getting attracted in a mundane sort of way. So a pure devotee is, dānya marks him out. Amongst many of his qualities, dānya is one of the outstanding. Even in the quality of sharanagati, humility makes the list. Utter humility makes the list in the six symptoms of surrender. So, you know, he's not puffed up thinking that, I can't be allured because I'm a pure devotee of Krishna. I can't be allured. Even though, so like this, we should be humble.
devotee means humble. This, that kind of idea. Yeah. There's a prayer in the residents offer prayers. The residents of Jamadweep offer prayers. And there's one prayer where it's saying that even if one is liberated, he can fall down. I don't actually remember the verse number. No, 5:18 is your chapter. Well, what's the verse number? No, it's not 18:8. That's Prahlad Maharaj offering prayers. Useless. Yeah.
Well, two examples that goes along with this topic. I was just discussing with Gokulananda Prabhu the other day because we just passed Priyavrata, who also was self-realized soul, but he was like, I want to get out of this horrible situation of my household enjoyment program. So we have lots of examples like that of great souls, even though they had the capacity to utilize things for Krishna, they weren't like wanting to stay in that place. And that's also like the essence of what's discussed in 10.14.58 in the Bhagavatam, you know. Those who have accepted the boat of the lotus feet of Krishna, the whole material ocean is like the water of a calf's footprint. But still their goal is Vaikuntha, where there's not danger at every step. And in the purport is explaining even Narada Muni is taking shelter of the Lord's lotus feet, even though he's the shelter for so many other living entities, etc. So it's like the devotees aren't... there's a difference qualitatively between Krishna's name, form, qualities, pastimes, etc., and contact with the material energy for the purpose of serving Krishna. There's a difference still. So, I don't know, just some more additional discussion on the topic.
Okay.
I was kind of spaced out here for a second, Prabhu, but I think you said, I remember Srila Prabhupada saying that every animal has his propensity and his strong points. Like an eagle, his sense of sight is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
A dog, his sense of smell is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other ones? The vulture, that's what the eagle, the vulture, you know. But I remember, you might even have said this, but it says in Kali Yuga, the senses of the human being all are very strong. But did you say that?
No.
All the senses are
yeah,
very
that's
strong.
On.
You said that?
I did not say that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's obvious. Although this was mentioned in the fourth canto a little bit early on by Narada Muni, that although the human form of life affords the opportunity for self-realization, Narada Muni also mentioned that it is in the human form of life that there is full power to exploit the material nature.
Yes.
Because of the developed intelligence and senses.
I remember Srila Prabhupada went to some continent and he says, big senses, big problem.
Hare Krishna. Are there any other questions? Yeah.
I was thinking that usually we cannot see when we are attached, but we can very easily see when someone else is attached. Like it's almost like obvious in our face that we see that they are attached. So what should be the attitude of a person who is actually seeing that the person is attached?
Oh, if you're seeing someone's attached, what should be the attitude? What should be our attitude toward that individual? Well, first thing that comes to mind is, man, I'm attached too. I know what you're going through. Another point that comes up is that what is my relationship to that individual? Why am I having to give that such a strong consideration in my mind? Is that a friend that I'm looking at? Or is it an enemy I'm looking at? Or someone I consider as an enemy? Like, man, they're attached. You know, they're going to fall down, you know. Like, or is it like a friend and you're concerned that they're attached and you want to, like, see, you know, you want to help out? Or so it depends on...
Like, usually like a friend, like, you know. And sometimes, like, the attachment is... I see the other person's attachment so much that, like, I feel that I become attached to something else that I cannot even chant. I'm thinking about...
Oh, you're attached. They're being attached, and so you can't think, you can't chant japa properly. Well, why don't you go and say something to that devotee? You know, walk up to the devotee and offer your humble obeisances. This is the first step, especially when you have to deal with a topic that's uncomfortable. The first thing you do, I've tried this twice in practice, and it really does work. It's mystical. First thing you do, go up to the devotee and say, Prabhu or Mataji, you know, please accept my humble obeisances, and hit the floor. Don't just go like this, you know, but actually hit the floor and offer your... And then the devotee's going to be bewildered, because we only do that in the morning program, right? We don't do, we don't do it throughout the day. That's a little awkward. So first thing, you're going to be bewildered. They're also going to offer their obeisances. And then you mention Prabhu, Mataji, whoever. I'm seeing like this, I'm concerned. Maybe I'm not seeing it properly. That thought should come up in our mind also. And there might be some discussion, you know. Ultimately, unless we ourselves are detached, we won't be able to help other persons so much become detached. You need empowerment by your own detachment from Maya in order to be empowered enough to really help others. We can try our level best. One thing we could also do is try to help that, maybe that individual connect to someone more powerful who could help them if they see the necessity for it. Otherwise, we have to offer our prayers like that. Many factors go into play. But seeing the concern for that individual's attachment outside of whatever you'll be able to do for them, that can make us examine ourselves more and, you know, of our own attachments. And then seeing how we can relinquish those. We can only help someone else if we have sufficient strength in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, Prahlad Maharaj says, Niskinchana nam navrnita yavat. Only if you smear the dust of a Niskinchana devotee on your head who has no attachment to matter, then you can be easily relieved from the anarthas and all these things like that. So we need the strength of Krishna consciousness to do some substantial work on the heart of another living entity. But as a friend, we're seeing that we may go and offer our businesses, have some discussion. I'm concerned. These are the reasons I'm concerned. Am I seeing it right? Or like that. Try to connect them to the spiritual master or some higher authority they can place their trust in. Like that, you know. Okay, so the time is up. So I go, and is that okay? Listen. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.